Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh, yay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas, this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. This morning there are three matters on the court's oral submission docket. In the order that we will hear them, they are Texas Department of Parks and Wildlife versus Maria and Ray Miranda from Uvalde County and the 4th Appellate District. Humble Sand and Gravel Incorporated versus Raymond Gomez and others from Jefferson County and the 6th Appellate District. And Sheffield Development Company Incorporated versus the City of Glen Heights from Ellis County and the 10th Appellate District. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and will conclude these arguments before the lunch break. You may purchase a tape of any argument for a nominal fee from the clerk of our court. Justice Rodriguez is not sitting today and will not participate in the deliberation of these cases unless something unexpected happens and rejoins the court in the near future. So the court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Texas Department of Parks and Wildlife versus Miranda.
May it please the court, Ms. Lisa Eskow will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, and may it please the court. When an injury occurs on recreational land, the legislature's limited waiver of sovereign immunity in the Tort Claims Act is narrowed by the recreational use statute, under which the state owes park visitors no greater duty of care than is owed a trespasser, and that is a duty not to injure a person through willful, wanton, or grossly negligent conduct. In this case, the Mirandas conclusorily alleged that the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department was grossly negligent in failing to keep Mrs. Miranda safe from a branch that fell from a pecan tree in Garner State Park. But they did not allege any facts to support that conclusory allegation, nor did they introduce any supporting evidence. As such, they failed to establish jurisdiction to sue the department.
Do you think that our decision in Bland, under the facts in this case, requires under a pleaded jurisdiction motion by the state for the plaintiff to come forward and establish proof on each element of their cause of action?
No, Your Honor, not proof on each element, but certainly they do have an obligation to allege facts, and the Court of Appeals and the trial court have an obligation to look beyond the pleadings and consider the department's jurisdictional evidence, which refuted any gross negligence.
The Court of Appeals here claimed that what the department's argument was is that there was no evidence of the allegations in the pleading. Is that the posture of the case?
No, Your Honor. I think what it truly is that there neither was evidence nor were there any factual allegations in the pleadings to support the conclusory allegation. And essentially, the Court of Appeals said because they said the department was grossly negligent, we have to assume that's true on a plea to the jurisdiction, and anything else is a matter for trial on the merits. And we believe that that's both inconsistent with this court's decision in Bland, as well as the court's sovereign immunity jurisprudence, which requires a plaintiff suing the state to establish facts or introduce evidence demonstrating that their claim falls within the legislative waiver of sovereign immunity, and that that's supported by the court's decision in Texas Department of Transportation versus Jones, in the court's decision in Texas Department of Criminal Justice versus Miller, and in the court's decision in Texas Natural Resource Conservation Commission versus White. In those circumstances, particularly in Miller and White, the court did not accept conclusory allegations or the mere invocation of a Tort Claims Act provision or a waiver as sufficient to confer jurisdiction. Instead, the plaintiff was required to have supporting evidence or supporting factual allegations. And here there is nothing in the Miranda's pleading that would support liability under the Tort Claims Act as modified by the recreational use statute. Indeed, all that they relied on in response to the state's plea to the jurisdiction, as well as the state's motions for summary judgment and its no evidence motion for summary judgment, was the very evidence that the state had put in before the trial court, which was evidence establishing that there had been no warning that this tree branch would fall, that there was no indication that it was dead or posed a danger, no one had ever reported anything, but that sometimes it's a natural phenomenon that branches will fall from trees, and it's the way in which trees naturally prune themselves, that this was just a natural occurrence, and nothing for which the department could be held liable or could be sued. And the Mirandas instead pointed to that evidence and said, the department knows that branches fall from trees, and they had an obligation to warn us about that or to make sure a branch didn't fall on us, and that's the basis for their suit. But as a matter of law, that fails to state a claim under the standard that establishes the waiver of sovereign immunity. And again, that is established by the intersection of the Tort Claims Act and the recreational use statute and the trespasser duty of care. Under the trespasser duty of care, there is no obligation to warn someone of a danger on the premises, nor is there any obligation to keep the premises safe. The only obligation is not to injure someone through willful, wanton, or grossly negligent conduct. And there is no conduct alleged in the Miranda pleadings that would fall within the Tort Claims Act waiver of sovereign immunity. There's no evidence of any, for example, use of tangible property that caused them injury or any other sort of conduct. All they've alleged is that the premises were not safe, it was dangerous for us to be under that tree, and that is simply not a duty that the department owed under the recreational use statute. And without a duty, there is no duty to breach, and there can be no liability. So on their theory of the case, there are no facts they could plead, and there's no evidence that they could put in that would ever establish liability on the part of the department. And because under the Tort Claims Act, the waiver of immunity from suit is coextensive with the waiver of immunity from liability, and that's in section 101.025 of the Tort Claims Act. That is the same inquiry, and where you have no liability, you have no immunity, or rather you have no waiver of an immunity from suit.
Well, now, my understanding is the petition did allege that the department knew about falling tree branches, that they failed to inspect, failed to prune, failed to alleviate, consciously and deliberately failed. What else could they allege factually than that to make this anything other than sort of a no evidence motion?
They would, in order to state a claim and fall within the waiver, they would have to allege some sort of willful, wanton, or grossly negligent conduct. And all of the allegations that they've made are failure to make the premises safe allegations. Those are all premises defect allegations. And under a trespasser standard of care, there is no duty to make the premises safe. And they have resisted that that is the appropriate standard of care. They've noted in their briefing that they don't concede that they were trespassers. But as a matter of law, that is the only standard that applied to them because the legislature made clear in its 1995 amendments to the Tort Claims Act and the recreational use statute that the recreational use statute does establish the government's, the state's liability for a premises defect claim. And to the extent it is more limited under the recreational use statute than it is under the Tort Claims Act, the recreational use statute is going to trump.
But if the allegations were sufficient to get them there on gross negligence, then did you lose?
No, Your Honor.
I mean, then your jurisdictional plea would become sort of a no evidence motion.
If they had... I disagree, Your Honor, in one respect. If they had just alleged gross negligence, as they did here, then...
No, I'm saying if they had alleged facts.
To support gross negligence.
Right.
And conduct as opposed to just a premises condition. If they had alleged that someone grossly negligently used a baton, a ranger used the baton they were carrying in a manner that injured someone, and they factually substantiate that, and there were facts to establish proximate causation, then they might have a use of tangible property claim. But anything short of that sort of conduct is not going to be actionable under these circumstances. There's nothing that they could allege factually that would establish liability under a trespasser duty of care when what they're talking about is harm from the natural surroundings in the park, which here is a tree. There's no allegation that a ranger was up on the tree sawing off the branch with a saw and it fell on them or was doing that in a grossly negligent manner. All they're saying is a tree branch fell, and the department knows that sometimes tree branches fall, and they didn't do anything to keep us safe from that. And there's no facts under which that could support liability or a waiver of immunity, because all that they had as trespassers, and of course that's a fiction because they weren't trespassers and they come to the park, but it is a fiction that the legislature has imposed and has required be imposed under these circumstances to confine the duty of care. And under that standard, there was absolutely no liability whatsoever. A trespasser takes the premises as they find them. It just doesn't give a owner of property free license to grossly negligently.
But if that's the case, if no facts can be alleged under this scenario, where's the conflict with Bland?
The conflict with Bland is in the Court of Appeals statement that there could be, or rather that they had to accept the conclusory allegation of grossly negligent conduct on its face and did not have to look past that to inquire whether there actually were facts or evidence to support it. And there could be grossly negligent conduct, just not of the type alleged by the Mirandas in this case. In theory, as I mentioned, they could have alleged some sort of grossly negligent use of tangible property, some other sort of conduct. But nothing that they alleged here substantiated their burden. But the Court of Appeals said we just have to take it on face value, that they've said grossly negligent. Grossly negligent is the standard. We don't look beyond the pleadings. That gets us to the merits, and it's an issue for trial. And in Bland, the court noted that trial courts are required to look beyond pleadings and look at jurisdictional evidence when necessary to resolve the inquiry. And the department had put forward evidence that even assuming there could be some sort of a theory of failure to warn from a condition on the property that was posing an extreme degree of risk and to which there was subjective awareness, that there was no ability to substantiate that. There was no evidence that anyone knew about any danger from this particular tree. There was no evidence that there was an extreme degree of risk. Instead, the evidence put in the record demonstrated that at most perhaps 20 trees had fallen in the assistant superintendent's 25 years with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, and never once had one struck a person.
The Court of Appeals says that the department had an obligation to specifically allege that the Mirandas pleadings were a sham that meant to improperly vest the trial court jurisdiction. How do you respond to that?
That is precisely what we believe conflicts with Bland versus Jefferson. And it is that statement that the court disapproved of in Bland. And indeed, in the Wilmer Hutchins versus Sullivan decision, this court reversed an opinion from the Dallas Court of Appeals that had said precisely the same thing, that it could not look past the pleadings unless the defendant had alleged that they were a sham or had been fraudulently alleged, the allegations therein. And the court said that conflicts with our decision in Bland. And if the Court of Appeals decision in Dallas in Wilmer Hutchins conflicts with Bland, then necessarily the San Antonio Court of Appeals decision in this case also conflicts with Bland because it did place that same precise restriction.
Did you file special exceptions to the petition?
No, Your Honor, we didn't. We filed the plea to the jurisdiction challenging the sufficiency of their pleadings in that manner. And we also filed the motion for summary judgment and the no evidence motion for summary judgment. And by filing the plea to the jurisdiction, it then was incumbent upon the plaintiff to either allege facts or come forward with some sort of evidence that would establish there was jurisdiction to proceed, particularly because we are dealing with a sovereign immunity case. And as the court's decisions in Miller and in White made clear, it is the plaintiff's burden to establish jurisdiction. And that must be done through concrete factual allegations, specific factual allegations, or through evidence. For example, in the Miller case, a plaintiff had alleged that her husband's death while incarcerated with the Texas Department of Criminal Justice was caused by the use of fluids or misuse of fluids and various medications that masked his symptom of meningitis, and that approximately caused his death. And this court did not accept on face value those allegations. Instead, it looked at the facts pleaded and determined whether there was indeed a waiver of sovereign immunity under those circumstances. And
I'm a little bit confused. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm trying to figure out how this works in the, I guess, waiver immunity context and comparing it to Bland. Even if the pleadings alleged sufficient facts to establish negligence, your position relying on Bland is that the trial court must look at evidence on those factual determinations if the state objects on a plea to the jurisdiction, because the Bland requires the court to look at that evidence. That seems to be your position. So, because you can't confine the trial court to just what's in the pleadings, even if the pleadings are sufficient in and of themselves to show facts showing jurisdiction, if the state challenges jurisdiction, the plaintiff must come forward with evidence establishing each of the elements of the cause of action, or they lose on the plea of jurisdiction. Isn't that the result of your position?
No, Your Honor. If there truly are facts that establish, and it would not be negligence in this case, it would have to be gross negligence, but if there were facts that establish that and the state filed a plea to the jurisdiction, unless under those circumstances the state was alleging there was something fraudulent about the specific facts alleged.
But you begin with the premise, if there are facts, there's no way the trial court would know about the facts but for hearing evidence. So even if the pleadings are sufficient to create jurisdiction for the trial court, if the state files a plea of the jurisdiction, there is no way the court could determine if the facts are have support than to take evidence on the merits of the plaintiff's claim in order to determine jurisdiction.
No, Your Honor, we believe that at the plea to jurisdiction stage, if there are facts that taken at face value would establish that there is a claim under the Act, that would be sufficient, and then proving those facts would be a matter for trial.
But as you say, if there are facts, the trial court will have to hear the evidence. A prima facie case, at least the plaintiff will have to come forward with some evidence on each of their elements in the face of a plea to jurisdiction.
No, Your Honor, we believe that the pleadings, if they truly stated a cause of action based on the facts alleged within the pleadings, then no, the plaintiff would not have a burden to come forward with evidence unless it were, for example, the situation that the court faced in Wilmer Hutchins versus Sullivan, where someone had conclusively alleged that they had exhausted their administrative remedies in a workers' comp retaliation suit, but the undisputed evidence established that the person had not. And under those circumstances, despite what was in the pleadings, the court would have to look to the jurisdictional evidence. But other than that scenario, where you have undisputed evidence that expressly refutes something, if a plaintiff is able to allege facts, and it is their burden to allege facts that expressly establish jurisdiction to proceed under the Tort Claims Act or some other waiver of immunity from suit, then no, they would not have to put on additional evidence unless there was something fraudulent.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Emmett Harris will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for hearing us today. The Mirandas did plead, as the fourth court has said in its opinion and as our pleadings show in their face. The department knew of negligence, had knowledge, failed to inspect, failed to prune, failed to alleviate or remove what the department knew was danger, consciously, deliberately failed to warn of the extremely dangerous condition, and that was willful, wanton, gross negligence. Now, alleging facts or presenting evidence of facts, as I listened to the argument, I thought about the concept of negligence. Negligence occurs in one of two ways. We either do something and we do it poorly. We do it contrary to what a reasonable, prudent person should and ought to do. Or we fail to do something.
But you'd agree that in order to get around the recreational use statute, you have to allege facts to establish gross negligence. We're not just talking about simple.
Absolutely. I don't quarrel with the existence of the Tort Claims Act and the further narrowing of the opening of the door by the recreational use statute. I think Mirandas have to eventually, if they ever do, get to a trial, prove gross negligence. There's no question. that. I think they have.
Do you disagree with the? I'm sorry. Do you disagree with the premise that facts have to be alleged to support gross negligence? I just want to make sure. Are you claiming that you did allege sufficient facts to establish gross negligence, or that specific facts are not required at this stage?
No, I think we have to make factual allegations in the petition, and I'm saying that I believe what we alleged were factual allegations. We didn't allege that somebody was performing conduct, sawing a limb and horsed around and dropping on somebody. We allege that people who had knowledge failed to do anything. Their inactivity, their absence of conduct under these conditions was grossly
bad. I'm still not sure I understand. So you claim that your petition, as alleged, factually and legally, is sufficient to establish gross negligence?
Yes, I do.
And if we disagree with that and think that the factual allegations don't get you to gross negligence, then do you lose?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question at the end.
If we look at the pleading and determine that sufficient facts to establish gross negligence have not been alleged, as you believe they have, then do you lose?
No, because another thing happened. When the plea to the jurisdiction was filed and pursued at trial level, there was a hearing at which evidence came in. It came in essentially in two forms. We had taken the deposition of Craig Van Barley, a park employee. The state introduced expert opinion on the part of Roy Inks, an expert literally in their employ, a member of the operations and maintenance part of their operation. And that evidence was before the trial court. Among the things that these two people said were that indeed 20 different times limbs had fallen, not in the forest with no one to hear, but on picnic tables and on campers, picnic tables that occasionally are occupied by human beings, camper vehicles that are occasionally occupied by human beings, and that they didn't inspect regularly campsites. These things Craig Van Barley said in his deposition. Mr. Inks said that it was, and I find this interesting, he said that it was commonly known that there was a syndrome called sudden branch drop syndrome. And that those were big words to describe the fact that occasionally
limbs fall off trees.
Hey, fall off trees. Exactly.
Sudden branch drop syndrome.
Right. Trees are going to drop limbs now.
Yeah.
And their expert said, we know that. It's commonly known that this happens. Besides that, Mr. Van Barley said, yes, it has happened.
What was the evidence, though, that an inspection would have revealed which limbs were going to drop so that they could have done so?
Well, as I recall, Van Barley said that they periodically went around looking at trees, and if they saw something that struck them as odd, they would get up there and tend to it. He didn't say that they regularly did that. He did say, I believe, that essentially they went and fixed things after the tree had dropped its branch.
I guess what I'm getting at, did you allege, or is there evidence in the record that would show that had they done a proper inspection, they could have determined that this limb was about to fall?
I don't know whether he could have stood under that 80-foot pecan tree in advance of the fall and from the ground and determined that that was about
or
to happen.
From any way, shape, or form, is there any evidence they could have said, aha, we better do something about that limb before
Well, he did say every once in a while they do that. They look up and they see something that is patently dead.
But I'm just asking about this limb. Is there any allegation or any kind of evidence that this particular limb, had they done what they were supposed to do, they could have determined that it was about to fall
well,
and sawed it off?
Certainly not. I don't think they said, boy, if we could just look, we had known that limb was going to fall on this morale and we'd cut it off when it did. No, he didn't say that. But the state is saying to you, we know internally, we the department know that this happens.
I'm getting at your allegations. What do you allege that they should have done about this particular limb that would have notified them it was about to fall?
We say the following. they failed to inspect. And when we say that, we're saying they should have inspected.
But what would the what do you allege an inspection of this limb would have shown before it fell?
We'll never know. It fell. I don't know what would have happened if they had climbed the tree and looked at it. But we allege more than that. We allege that they also failed to prune, and that they failed to warn. If they knew that this happened, and perhaps all of you have been to Garner Park. There are some big trees there. I first saw them in 1950 when I was a kid, and they were big then. Like me, they are now 50 years older than they were then. And you know, things, I just hope, don't start falling off of me. They didn't warn. That is a specific allegation of conduct, the failure to warn. I remember hearing someone argue that it would have been cost prohibitive for them to warn. How tough would it be to stick a little sign on the gate and say, we got some big trees, the limbs fall occasionally, be careful, watch out for...
Would that duty exist beyond just the department? In other words, everyone here in this room now knows that tree branches fall naturally in nature. So do we all, if we have trees on our property, in our homes, do we have the duty to post signs to anyone coming to our front door?
I suspect if they had done that, if they had posted a warning, we wouldn't be here.
How far does that warning extend? In other words, if there's the warning for the department, is there a warning for us, for citizens? I mean, just to warn generally to make sure everyone knows that tree limbs sometimes fall.
Do we all individually have a duty to hit the streets and spread the gospel that limbs will fall?
On our property. I have great oak trees on my property. Do I have a duty to, now that I know that limbs fall generally in nature, do I have a duty to warn people of that?
I think the question would be different in your case at your home with your tree because you're not the state. You're not an entity that is covered and partially insulated by the Texas Tort Claims Act. And I'm not sure what your duty as an individual homeowner would be. But I am sure what the state of Texas ought to do, if it knows, as it did, that this happens.
Should they evacuate the park or windstorm?
No, not at all. I believe that there are currently signs in and around the park that say things like, watch out for falling rocks. Had there been a sign on that gate that said, watch out for falling limbs, I don't know that we'd be here. We certainly couldn't argue to you that they failed to warn.
I mean, other than not going to the park, what can you really do? You watch all the time, just make sure you never stand near a tree?
No, there's no way.
I'm trying to understand what the warning does. There's a lot of things. The warnings say operate a certain piece of machinery this way, or if this starts to happen, don't do that. But as far as limbs come down pretty fast.
What the warning would have done was keep me at home today because I couldn't be here telling you that they had failed to warn. An ironic conversation took place at the gate, and I doubt this happens very often. Mr. and Ms. Miranda literally said, we want a safe place to camp. They actually said that. I don't imagine that occurs very often.
But
and the people at the park said, here's one right here.
You say in your brief that anyone with common sense knows that limbs fall and that if they fell on you, they could hurt you. So what good's a warning in those circumstances?
The good is that as the state department, you would have at least done what you could to warn. And you would have, in your selfish best interest, insulated against the allegation that the absence of warning was grossly negligent.
But it seems like you might as well warn, don't step in holes or something. I mean, everybody knows not to do that. Not very many people think, there's a hole. I think I'll step in it and see what happens. I mean, it's always an accident. It's hard to see how you could avoid it by posting a warning at the gate.
Certainly posting a warning wouldn't stop the limb from falling. Certainly posting the warning wouldn't have stopped someone from passing beneath the tree.
But Mr. Harris, the position of the state is virtually they can concede everything that you've said. There should have been a warning out there. They should have gone out to inspect.
But to get to the wanton disregard, you really have to say, almost to the point, that there was a high degree of risk of very serious injury from this limb falling on a camper. And thus far, all you've said is, well, they should have been inspecting the trees in this park, that their knowledge was really consistent with what everybody else knows, that limbs fall off of trees. And we don't even know, had they done this, that they'd even been able to find that this was the particular limb that was going to fall. It seems to me nothing about what you've said has demonstrated a high knowledge of a high degree of risk of serious injury, so, which is kind of this malice deal we're talking about. And you have yet to describe the risk of this limb falling being so imminent, and the Parks Department people knowing that limb was going to fall. I think that's a whole issue here. You don't even have that in your pleadings, and what I've heard you say is the evidence doesn't even come close to that. So can you point to what evidence you say it
is? The evidence that was before the trial court was before the trial court during the argument of a dilatory plea to the jurisdiction. We did not try the case before the trial court on the dilatory plea. We showed our allegations. We argued that they did indeed allege gross negligence and facts that would, if true, if believed by a Uvalde jury, amount to gross negligence. And the court had before it the deposition of Greg Van Barley and Roy Inks, read in sections and out of context. Either of us can argue that evidence proved or failed to prove negligence of a gross degree. But Judge Pennington had some evidence in front of him, and he said, based on this, you've at least wound up in the right courthouse. You are where you can pursue relief. I'm not telling you that what he had before him was enough to convince a jury at a trial that we were entitled to a verdict. But I certainly think there was enough before him where he could say, I think the court has jurisdiction. He did, of course, and so, of course, did the Court of Appeals. You have described it as a dilatory plea in Bland versus Blue and other places. I want to say that word has particular resonance to me in this case. The Mirandas filed their suit in May of 1999. It is now October of 2002. They've been trying to get to the courthouse for 3 years and 5 months to be heard by a Uvalde County jury, some of whom, no doubt, have gone to Garner Park, some of whom may work for Garner Park. They can't get in the courthouse because of a dilatory plea that's kept them out for 3 years plus. They do not, and I don't think any of the cases require them to plead the totality of their evidence, listing witnesses, summarizing testimony. I don't think any petition has to do that. We have to show that we're proceeding under the Tort Claims Act and recreational use statute. We're alleging gross negligence. We're saying willful and wanton conduct or failures to act occurred, and that was what resulted in her getting scalped.
Now, we don't reach any of this unless we find jurisdiction, right?
Yeah.
We won't reach any of these arguments unless we have jurisdiction to do that.
Exactly.
Can you articulate why this case does not conflict with Bland?
I don't know that it conflicts. I simply say that you can look at Miranda's pleadings and see that they alleged facts that they said and alleged were grossly negligent.
But that's the merits.
Pardon me?
That's the merits. In order to reach the merits, we've got to determine that the Court of Appeals' opinion conflicts with Bland. And tell me why you think it does not.
That's the frustration. The frustrating place where the Mirandas of the world are left in a situation like this. In effect, the state is arguing that they had to try their case in toto at trial level in order to establish jurisdiction.
But they say not. I mean, they just,
pardon me?
They say not. They just now told us not.
Well, and I was pleasantly surprised to hear them say that. I don't think we have to.
For this court to have jurisdiction as opposed to the trial court, since this is a dilatory plea, it's interlocutory, we don't have jurisdiction to get to the merits unless what the Court of Appeals opinion says conflicts with Bland. And can you explain to us why what the Court of Appeals said is consistent with what we said in Bland?
Is consistent?
Yes. So that they don't conflict and our court doesn't have appellate jurisdiction.
I think you have jurisdiction to consider this jurisdictional issue. I don't think you have jurisdiction to try the case, and I don't think we have to try the case here. Maybe we do. Maybe the Mirandas can't get to court anywhere. I remember Scout Finch's Daddy Atticus saying that our courts are great levelers. That's fiction. That's from a novel. But it is not a fiction that our courts should be places where the least of these can gain and present their case without having to joust for 3 years plus and listen to a bunch of people in black suits parse words, the result of which is to keep the doors of the courthouse closed for these folks. That's not right, and that's not fair, it's not just. They pled facts. They pled that those facts, failures to act, warn, alleviate, inspect, etc., were grossly negligent. There was evidence before that court that would have helped Judge Pennington see, well, yeah, it looks like there are some facts here that, if a jury believed truly occurred, might find these people grossly negligent. Don't shut the doors of the system to the Mirandas of the world by parsing words. We pled facts. We claimed they were amounted to gross negligence. We can't be required to try our case in toto at the jurisdictional issue level. Judge Pennington was right when he found he had judicial jurisdiction. I believe the Court of Appeals in San Antonio was right when they said that.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
If the department had to warn of every danger that might exist in a state park, including tree limbs falling, the presence of some animals, bobcats, the possibility that there may be floods and rainy weather, that rocks may be slippery, that holes in the ground may exist, then there could be no state parks. Indeed, it would be very unlikely that people would open their recreational land for public use if this were the duty, and that's specifically why the legislature created the Recreational Use Act, to encourage people to open their land without having to incur liability under these circumstances. Indeed, in the legislative history of the 1995 amendments, under which the legislature made clear that the act applies to governmental entities, there was testimony from the bill's author that one of the main problems was a reluctance on landowners' parts to let people onto their recreational land because of the rough terrain. Apparently there had been a number of incidents with bobcats attacking fishermen that year suddenly.
But my question here isn't who should win a trial or whether you can get a summary judgment. It's what you have to plead in order to get your first foot into the courthouse.
Precisely, Your Honor. And here it's evident from the Mirandas' pleadings, it's evident from the evidence that the department put in and on which the Mirandas relied in the trial court and their argument today that there are no facts that could bring this suit within the jurisdiction of the trial court and within the waiver of sovereign immunity. All they are alleging is a failure to warn and a failure to protect.
Did you get the conflict with Bland? To say that the CA's opinion conflicts with Bland, the CA thinks that the pleadings are sufficient. To get a conflict with Bland, don't you really have to say
that in the face of a plea of the jurisdiction, the trial court must take evidence on the elements of the plaintiff's claim before they can decide whether or not the plea of the jurisdiction is good?
No, Your Honor, I think you have a precise conflict because the Court of Appeals stated that it could not, it was prohibited from looking beyond the pleadings because the department had not specifically alleged that the pleadings were a sham.
Well, let's get real specific here. The Court of Appeals said the trial court was not authorized to inquire into the substance of the claims because it concluded that the pleading facially stated the cause of action for gross negligence. So isn't really the determining what the Court of Appeals' real holding was that these pleadings are sufficient? And does that establish a conflict with Bland? Aren't we really looking at whether these pleadings allege gross negligence or not? And if that's all we're really looking at, how does that conflict with Bland?
Certainly, I think that is the merits inquiry on the jurisdictional question under the Tort Claims Act. But in terms of the conflict, the court did, as a prerequisite to that holding, state that it could not look past because it did note the department had not specifically alleged that the pleadings were a sham, and that does conflict with Land. In addition, its unwillingness to assess whether facts actually establish a waiver of sovereign immunity under the Tort Claims Act conflicts with Texas Department of Transportation versus Jones and with the TNRCC versus White decision, in which the court said that you don't confer jurisdiction merely by invoking the Tort Claims Act or by merely reciting the elements of a Tort Claims Act claim. You have to have facts in there, or if you can't do it through facts, then you may have to put on evidence.
But these allegations were far more specific than the allegations in Jones.
These allegations were more specific, but not with respect to facts, with respect to conclusory legal allegations, and no facts there, just the allegations of failure to warn, failure to protect, which is similar to saying, I have a claim under the Tort Claims Act. It is more specific than that, but is analogous, for example, in Miller to saying the injuries were proximately caused, but not putting forth any facts or evidence to actually establish proximate causation.
How does this interface with the rules of civil procedure and the standard for sufficient pleading, which is fair notice? Fair notice of the claim.
That is certainly the pleading standard, Your Honor. But
doesn't that also, then, if it gives fair notice of the claim, wouldn't that also be the standard that we would use to ascertain whether or not it came within a waiver of immunity in the Tort Claims Act?
No, Your Honor. The burden is greater on a plaintiff attempting to sue the state. The restriction is not just a have you stated a claim that exists at law. The issue is have you brought yourself within a waiver, and in the court's decisions in, for example, Miller and
White. But I understand, but I'm talking about for determining how specific the factual allegations must be, and that seems to me to be at the crux of this case. Is how specific do the facts have to be to avoid being conclusory, and it seems to me then you're talking about fair notice.
We would disagree, Your Honor. We believe this is a jurisdictional inquiry because sovereign immunity is...
Okay, but how do you test the facts then?
I think you lay them out against the actual terms of the waiver. For example, in the White case, the court noted that for the first time in briefing to this court, the plaintiff had alleged that a motor-driven pump that was placed on her property, the actual use of that pump had caused an aggregation of fumes that caused an explosion and damage to her property. But there were no facts, the court noted, in the petition, and there was no evidence that actually supported that theory, and therefore she had failed to invoke a waiver, even though had she put facts in or evidence, it might have fallen, and in that instance, the court dismissed the suit for want of jurisdiction, as we believe the court should do here, and we ask the court to. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument and the first calls. The court will take a brief recess.
All rise.